Just the two of us.
Yes. Emily is currently flying around the globe.
Yep.
Capturing all the evil spirits that float around it.
Okay.
Yes. So she'll be back next week.
She'll be back next week. we'll be terrible covers if we're ever caught in a bind. so we have an amazing interview today with Mayor Christopher Taylor of Ann Arbor, Michigan, a city that has a lot of significance to both James and I, and Emily.
And Emily, yeah.
Yeah. It's an amazing conversation. He's a fantastic mayor, a fantastic person, and we're very excited to share it with you. So stick around after we tell you all the sad things happening to get inspired.
Sad and foolish.
Yeah, sad and foolish. Yes. So speaking of sad and foolish, the State of the Union happened, and it's not that big of a deal. Everyone makes a big deal about the State of the Union. It's not a big deal. It never really changed numbers for Obama. It's just, it's pomp and circumstance. That's what the State of the Union is. I watched bits of it. I'll be honest, I didn't watch all of it because I realized if Donald Trump just read from the teleprompter and didn't throw up on himself, he'd be hailed as presidential. Or if he said something racist or misogynist or xenophobic or whatever, it would just be par for the course at this point.
The bar is set so low for him that reading one sentence would be triumph for him.
Yeah,
so.
I forget who it was, but I think it was Joy Reid said, pay attention to not who Trump is when he reads from the teleprompter. Pay attention to who he is at 3 a.m. on Twitter. And that's the real person.
Mm-hmm.
So, so he did the State of the Union. He took a lot of credit for things that Obama had done. So this is a GQ article written by Jay Willis where he talks about that. Here are some of the claims. He said that since the election, we've created 2.4 million new jobs. The United States has yet to experience a single month of net job loss since October 2010 when Barack Obama was president. He said that manufacturing jobs in this country have been slowly but gradually increasing since 2010. Barack Obama was also the president then. He also said that inflation-adjusted wages have been steadily on the rise since 2014. Obama was the president then. He said the figure has been plummeting since April 2009. Obama was president then. Unemployment, rather. He said that African-American unemployment rate has been decreasing since 2011, and Obama was president then. I mean, every single thing he said, it was like, oh, yeah, Obama was the president. The tax cuts have not been enacted yet. And by the way, we are headed for a default. Like, they have to raise the debt ceiling again. Yeah. The government is running out of money.
But they were warned about this. They knew this was going to happen.
Yeah, and one of the reasons they can't pay for it is because of this stupid tax cut.
It's just getting frustrating because, I don't know how much longer he can ride off the coattails of what Obama has done.
Not much.
But the fact that he doesn't actually recognize that, like, he refuses to say, you know, anything positive about Obama's legacy and what he enacted while he was in office.
Right.
And that Trump is benefiting from those actions. It's harrowing that he and his administration is doing everything they can to dismiss that. You know, like, you have to give credit to Obama, and then if you're going to do anything positive, it better show up soon, because so far we are a year into your presidency and you have done nothing.
Nothing. Except for those tax cuts, which he also claimed were the biggest tax cuts in history, which were also not true.
And also he said that this was the highest rated or highest viewed State of the Union. I think it ranked 6th.
Like, I don't even know if it was that high.
Like, Stop.
It's got to stop. It's unbelievable. He also mentioned that how much he loved Puerto Rico in the State of the Union. As he mentioned that, FEMA announced that they were to officially shut off food and water aid to Puerto Rico. This is from a Hill article, or an article from The Hill by John Bowden, where he said that FEMA announced Tuesday that it will end free supplies of food and water in Puerto Rico this week as the island's supermarkets and other businesses reopen following Hurricane Maria. So one of the reasons that they're doing this is to stabilize the economic market. They say that if they keep supplying food and water to Puerto Rico, then nobody will buy anything from supermarkets and there won't be a flowing economy. So that's the way they're justifying this. But Bowden writes in the article that not all of Puerto Rico's government officials agree with the agency's decision to end aid this week. Morovis Mayor Carmen Maldonado told NPR that in her town, the number of customers without power restored to their homes is close to 80%, 80, and that most residents can't afford the cost of a generator. In a statement to The Hill, FEMA's Public Affairs Director William Boer clarified that the agency would continue to assist volunteer agencies and nonprofits with relief efforts in rural areas of Puerto Rico, as well as the territory's government. This is not good.
Mm-hmm.
80% of any area within a U.S. territory, Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. So if you want to help out, you can check out directrelief.org. You can, if you go to press donate, you can choose if you want to just send money to their organization in general, or you can send it specifically to Puerto Rico Relief. You can also go to thehopeheroes.org. That's another organization that is actively helping out in Puerto Rico.
And they definitely need the help. And I think Houston is actually still going through some things too.
Yes.
They're not in the news as much, and unfortunately, it's in the same way that Puerto Rico wasn't really being covered as well. But there's still a lot of people that are displaced right now. So do everything that you can to just donate and help some of these people get back on their feet.
I think if you go to directrelief.org, there is also a Houston section. I could be wrong on that. But you can donate to them, and they will most likely be involved in that as well. Yeah. It's good that Emily's not here this week in a way,
so
because there's
much.
So much Russia stuff.
Gosh.
There
Actually,
is so
I,
much
you know
Russia
what?
Stuff.
I, maybe, I don't know, there's like a, like kind of osmosis going on, but now I'm tired of it. But it's just, it felt like the longest, first of all, January felt like the longest month ever.
I know, a lot of people have been saying, well, because wasn't there a super moon?
There was a super moon, yes.
I didn't see the super
the
moon.
The blood, super blood moon.
I've been real
the blood
moody
of the
this
innocent.
Month,
I don't
so
really
maybe
know.
That's...
But all this Russian news came, and it started off on Monday. With
we said this last week, remember?
Oh, we did say this last
week.
We were
like, we'll find out on Monday if he'll impose sanctions.
So this is like, that was the cliffhanger.
Right. I thought that he, okay, sorry. I don't mean to keep interrupting you, but I'm gonna. Because I thought that they were going to, I didn't think they were going to impose the sanctions. I thought that they were just going to ignore it and hope it went away. They were like, they released a statement saying that they weren't going to do it.
Yep.
Wow.
Which is weird because this is I mean, at least in our lifetime, I don't remember this happening, but that a president and his administration is blatantly ignoring a law and taunting it in our faces.
A veto-proof law.
Yes.
A veto-proof law.
It's like, I know he was like crying while he signed it, but like you still have to enforce it, sir.
Yeah.
So this CNN article... by Nicole Gawet and Donna Borak, U.S. names Russian oligarchs in, quote, Putin list, but imposes no new sanctions. So the U.S. released a sweeping list of prominent Russian business and political figures in defiance of Moscow and implementing a congressional law designed to punish Russia for election meddling. The U.S. Treasury report, published shortly before a midnight deadline, which was last week, listed every senior member of the political administration at the Kremlin and every Russian oligarch with a net worth of $1 billion or more. Some of those names had already been subject to U.S. sanctions, but the administration stopped short of imposing any new punishments, saying the legislation was already doing its job. The report was, quote, not a sanctions list, it said. The Trump administration was required to publish the list by the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, which is CASTA.
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 It's like CASA or CASA.
Or yeah. Just CASTA. But
sure.
And which was meant to punish Russia for its interference in the 2016 U.S. election, as well as an alleged human rights violations, the annexation of Crimea, and ongoing military options in eastern Ukraine. How much longer does that list need to get for everyone to just be like, hey, they're kind of bad. We should.
Well, everybody is saying that, except for the president. Everybody's saying that. Everybody's saying that.
Sorry about your eardrums there, kids.
Yeah.
So we start off with that, with the no, with basically ignoring U.S. law, congressional, you know, crisis. Now we have this Washington Post article, Russian spy chiefs met in Washington with CIA director to discuss counterterrorism. So this happened before the sanctions were ignored, mind you. But two top Russian spy chiefs traveled to Washington last week to discuss counterterrorism issues with CIA director Mike Pompeo. But the unusual visit also raised concerns among some U.S. officials that Moscow could interpret the encounter as a sign the Trump administration is willing to move beyond the issue of election interference, current and former U.S. intelligence officials said. So we shouldn't really be interacting with them if, you know, there's this whole thing about collusion going on.
No, we shouldn't.
And so it seems to be a recurring thing where Trump will constantly say, no, there's nothing going on. Fake news, fake news. Why aren't you imposing sanctions? Why are people from your team meeting with Russia? Why is the world ending? Like, what is going on?
Yeah, I just think this is, I can't believe what's happening. I feel bad because we always talk about this Russia stuff and there's not really anything, because with Puerto Rico, you can donate money with the FCC and net neutrality, you can call your representative. With anything else, you can just, like, you get involved. I don't know what to do here. Mueller, I just think you should have patience. And if you have family members that are saying, well, if there's an investigation, how come there's no proof? Nobody turns in a paper before it's done unless you have a really interested professor that, in helping out your grades.
So I always plug Reddit for many things, but there's a very interesting thread that someone put together where they're saying, like, there's really no evidence of Trump colluding with Russia except for, and so if you go to Reddit Keep Track, which I've told you guys about before, there's literally a full list of, and it's almost like a paper trail, if you want to call it. I think there's got to be at least 100 different articles about ways that Russia has been involved with Trump. So if you want to just take a look at some of those things and just figure out why there would be any, you know, suspicion about this collusion, that's a perfect place to go. It's right there. And then we can post this link up somewhere in our social media in the next couple of days so you can see that.
Let's talk about this memo.
Yes.
We've created a different section for this memo, this dumb memo by dumb Devin Nunes.
But here's the thing. I don't normally say this, but I feel like this memo was a nothing burger.
Yeah.
I
agree with you.
They built it up for nothing.
Yes. So, okay. Okay. I read the memo. It's three pages. How dare you? So it's three pages. Which I think it was written short by design so that it was easily digested by the American public. Everything about this screams of partisanship. Okay. So, man, I am hot. So, this is an NBC News article by Ken Dion Leon, Julia Ainsley, and Adam Edelman, where it says the GOP Devin Nunes memo released alleging FBI cover-up. So, in it, they write that the House Intelligence Committee on Friday made public a Republican memo that raises questions about the FBI surveillance of one of Donald Trump's campaign aides, acting after the president declassified the entire document, which he says shows the law enforcement agency was biased against him. The disclosure came despite the opposition of the FBI, which feared it would reveal investigative methods, and the Justice Department. So the FBI and the DOJ opposed the release.
And they were also saying there were inaccuracies. They were saying,
Oh, we'll get to that. So the 3.5-page memo was prepared by the Intelligence Committee's chairman and resident jackass, Rep. Devin Nunes, I added that, and is a critique of the FBI's application for surveillance authority that was presented to the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, court. The memo says that a dossier compiled on Trump by Christopher Steele, a former British spy, was a key part of information shown to the FISA court for the surveillance approval of Page. The GOP memo, however, also says that information given to the court did not reveal that the dossier was financed by the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign. So, quick note, yes, the Clinton campaign and the DNC did pay for some of the dossier's research, but the initial payments for the dossier were financed from the Washington Free Beacon, which is a conservative news outlet. They go on to write that a Democratic congressional source who has read the classified Democratic memo, which was written to counter the Republican memo and has not been made public, said the FISA judges were made aware that there was a political context to Steele's information, meaning that it came from a political opponent of Trump, that refutes a key assertion in the GOP memo. Meanwhile, four separate FISA judges reviewed the surveillance application and renewals of Page, a Democratic congressional source told NBC News. So, a couple things to keep in mind. These FISA warrants need to be re-upped every 90 days, and they are reviewed by four different federal judges. And it's not just the dossier. You cannot warrant surveillance of an American citizen just based on a document like the dossier. The GOP memo left out that they did mention that there were some politically motivated options, especially the DNC and the Clinton campaign funding the DNC. The GOP left out that... What else did they... I mean, they left out so many things that paint a full picture of this dossier.
Well, what gets me is that Devin Nunes, he even admits that he didn't read the whole thing, so the actual FISA documents.
He didn't read it.
And so what they did is they cherry-picked certain things from the documents, and then he put that in his memo. So he doesn't even know all the context of everything he's talking about.
But you also need, you need overwhelming evidence to approve the surveillance of an American citizen. The dossier, one, has never been considered overwhelming evidence, and two, and I cannot stress this enough, it has always been considered a piece of corroborating information, meaning that the FBI already had reason to look into Carter Page, meaning that the FBI already had evidence in their investigation of collusion of the Trump campaign. The dossier, which was made by a credible person in Christopher Steele, is a piece of corroborating information. It corroborates. Oh, my goodness. So... there are holes in the argument. This is a New York Times article by Nicholas Fandos, Charlie Goldman, and Charlie Savage, in which they write that House Republicans released secret memo accusing Russia investigators of bias. And they said that the memo fell well short of making the case promised by some Republicans that the evidence it contained could cast doubt on the origins of the Russia investigation and possibly undermine the inquiry, which has been taken over by a special counsel Robert Mueller. The Page warrant is just one aspect of the broader investigation. Instead, the document confirmed the that contacts between a former Trump foreign policy advisor, George Papadopoulos, and Russian intermediaries were a primary factor in the opening of the investigation in July 2016. So they confirmed that in the dossier. So that's already out the window. They didn't talk about that. A 10-page Democratic memo, which, by the way, was not voted to be released. They only voted to release the Republican one. Written to rebut the Republican document, says that the FBI was more forthcoming with the surveillance court than the Republicans say. This is what I meant earlier. The FBI told the court that the information it received from Mr. Steele was politically motivated, though the agency did not say it was financed by Democrats, according to two people familiar with the Democratic memo. In December 2017, the Republican memo said Andrew G. McCabe, then the deputy director of the FBI, told the House Intelligence Committee that no surveillance would have been sought without Mr. Steele's information. But people familiar with the Democratic memo said Republicans had distorted what Mr. McCabe had told the Intelligence Committee about the importance of the information for Mr. Steele. Mr. McCabe presented the material as part of a constellation of compelling evidence that raised serious suspicions about Mr. Page that the two people said. The evidence included contacts Mr. Page had in 2013 with a Russian intelligence operative.
Which he boasted about.
Which he talked about. He was also formerly a Moscow investment banker. A Russian spy tried to turn. So he has been under investigation or being watched by the FBI since 2013. So the dossier was not created until 2016. So that's already out the window. Mm-hmm. The warrant was renewed three times, which is required every 90 days, meaning Mr. Page was under surveillance for about a year. At various points in the renewals, other law enforcement officials who signed off included Dana Boente, now the general counsel of the FBI, Mr. McCabe, and Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general who appointed Mr. Mueller as special counsel and has been part of a target of the president's displeasure over the Russia inquiry. This is just all this is trying to discredit the Russia investigation so that they can fire Rod Rosenstein, which is going to happen any day now, and then fire Robert Mueller. And if they do, I suggest look this up online, what to do in the event. There is a action.org, I believe.
I believe so. And it's set up around the country. People have, they've got marches planned. They've got protests going. So if that does happen, there's immediate action to be taken. Take to the streets.
It's called Nobody is Above the Law. It's act.moveon.org/offense/Mueller. Firing rapid response. So be part of that rapid response because that could happen any day. We are hurtling towards a constitutional crisis, if not already a part of one. Everything that is being done by the Republicans is to completely ruin the validity of this investigation. It is ridiculous. It is partisan. It is despicable. It is so sad.
Let's flip the script
just
a little
lost
bit.
Lost it there.
No, no. It's these are important things to talk about, but so are these things. All right. So here's a little bit of good news. All right. So first, from Ars Technica by John Brodkin, California Senate defies FCC, approves net neutrality law. So the California State Senate on Monday approved a bill to impose net neutrality restrictions on internet service providers, challenging the Federal Communications Commission attempt to preempt such rules. So the FCC's repeal of its own net neutrality rules included a provision to preempt state and municipal governments from enforcing similar rules at the local level. But the governors of Montana and New York have signed executive orders to enforce net neutrality, and several states are considering net neutrality legislation. So the FCC is already being sued by 21 states and the District of Columbia, which are trying to reverse the net neutrality repeal and the preemption of state laws. Attempts to enforce net neutrality rules at the state or local level could end up being challenged in separate lawsuits. This is great. I love when states, you know, whether governors, you know, when they speak out against these things.
Yeah.
When you know if for the betterment of your people that you represent, that like something like net neutrality is a good thing, and you stand up for that. And I'm so glad to hear that these states are behind that.
I think it's so funny, too, that all these Democratic-run governments have suddenly become the champion of small government.
Right. And then next on the list, we have Trey Gowdy announces retirement from Congress.
That's great news. Yes. That's not even good news.
This is great news.
He's a monster.
This is the Hill article by Ben Camisar. So Representative Trey Gowdy from South Carolina, the chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, surprised Washington on Wednesday by announcing that he will not run for re-election. Gowdy, he's 53 and is the 10th committee chairman to decide against re-election in 2018. Remember that. An exodus that has raised concerns about a brain drain within the GOP ranks. The former prosecutor took over the Oversight and Government Reform Committee in June, replacing former Representative Jason Chaffetz after his sudden retirement.
Chaffetz.
Oh, sorry.
Gotcha.
Well, hey, at least I know how to say Mueller.
I said...
And you said Mueller, so yeah.
I don't think that I said Mueller. I said something else.
No. You said Mueller. I heard it.
It's review the tapes.
It's literally on the podcast.
Review the tapes.
Go ahead. A couple episodes
Great.
Back.
I'm fine with that.
All right. And lastly on the good news front, San Francisco to dismiss thousands of marijuana convictions.
This is awesome.
This is an NPR article by James Dubek and Richard Gonzalez. So prosecutors in San Francisco will throw out thousands of marijuana-related convictions of residents dating back to 1975. San Francisco District Attorney George Gasson said Wednesday that his office will dismiss and seal 3,038 misdemeanor convictions dating back before the state's legalization of marijuana went into effect, with no action necessary from those who were convicted. Prosecutors will also review up to 4,940 felony convictions and consider reducing them to misdemeanors. Gasson's office also noted racial discrepancies in marijuana arrests and sentencing. Mm-hmm. In 2000, African Americans were 7.8% of San Francisco's population, but comprised 41% of marijuana arrests. By 2010 and 2011, African Americans made up about half of the marijuana-related arrests, yet represented only 6% of the city's population, according to the district attorney's office. In a statement, Gasson said San Francisco was taking the lead to undo the damage that this country's disastrous failed drug war has had on our nation and on communities of color in particular. Mm. This is a great thing.
Well, you know what they say. No one leads like Gasson. No one leads like Gasson.
I know what you did, but...
It's kind of fun.
I'm just going to ignore it.
I bet somebody listening thought of that and feels good that I'm saying it. I bet you someone's day is brightened. And you know what, James? I think politics is about helping the group as a whole, but also people individually.
I don't like this bit. Mm. You want to talk about our candidate to get excited about?
We can talk about our candidate to get excited about. Yeah, we really blew through that Russia stuff. I thought that would take longer. I'm so mad about it.
Why don't you channel that anger into some excitement for this candidate?
So, we have our candidate to get excited about this week. As you might remember from earlier, when I briefly just blacked out. Devin Nunes is a stupid man who is a partisan hack who does not deserve to represent a trash can, let alone anybody in government. So he has somebody challenging him for California's 22nd district. His name is Andrew Janz. And we read into Andrew Janz. He's a really cool guy. So he is the current deputy district attorney with the Fresno County District Attorney's Office. And we looked into his issue. So, and he wrote, which I think is kind of cool, and we'll get into this too with Mayor Taylor, you know, talking to people, getting face to face with people. And instead of writing, this is, I guess, semantics, but I thought it was neat. Instead of writing issues, important issues to me, he wrote important issues to California 22, which is great. And they include healthcare, crime, immigration, investing in students and teachers, water for the valley, women's health, economy, gun safety, climate change, protecting and expanding Medicaid, ending Citizens United, clean drinking water, criminal justice reform, dignity and aging, mental health, veteran issues, accountability and accessibility, and investing in early childhood development, protecting our dreamers, and he wrote at the bottom, more coming soon. which I also really enjoyed. I think he's a really interesting candidate. He's been endorsed by Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, who's the chair of the California Democratic delegation to Congress. He's been endorsed by Congressman Jerry McKerney, Congressman Mark Takano, Congressman Ami Berra, California State Board of Equalization member Fiona Ma, the president of the California Association of Counties and Kern County Supervisor Leticia Perez, former Fresno County Supervisor Henry R. Perea, and a slew of other people. He comes highly recommended. If you want to get involved, you can go to www.andrewjansforcongress.com. Jans is spelled J-A-N-Z, so that's andrewjansforcongress.com. Click on that donate button. Get involved. Go to act.moveon.org if you want to be part of the Mueller firing rapid response unit. We will take to the streets in a big, bad way if anything happens. You can also check out, like we said before, thehopeheroes.org or directrelief.org if you want to help out with Puerto Rico. If you want to call the Senate and just be very angry at them.
They need it.
Call 202-224-3121, then ask to be patched to your representative or a representative from another state like Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, who might truly be the root of all evil. Also, if you want to maintain, if you have a almost masochistic view on staying up to date with Russia, you can Google Hamilton 68. It is a really wonderful tool which compiled some of the top Russian Twitter users that are verified like Twitter bots, and it creates sort of a congregates all of the data together, and it shows where their hashtags, what they're talking about, and then what consequently conservative media will most likely talk about, because the right wing of the United States is currently ruled by a foreign power.
On that note, guys, we have an awesome interview coming up. gosh, it falls apart when Emily's not here. but anyway, yes. So we have Ann Arbor Mayor Christopher Taylor. Again, it's a wonderful interview.
He's such a great guy.
He's so awesome.
Super pumped to have him.
So stick around and we'll be right back with that interview.
Bye. Hi, guys. Welcome back. We are very excited. We have a fun interview today with Mayor Christopher Taylor of Ann Arbor. Mayor Taylor, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, yeah. And it's so nice because Nick and I both graduated from University of Michigan.
Go Blue.
And so we love Ann Arbor. It's I tell people, anyone that's never been there, I tell them you have to go. It's one of the most amazing cities. It's beautiful. It's culturally diverse. There's always something there. And I, you know, it's what a great person to have that represents this beautiful city. So I'm so excited to have you on here.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, Ann Arbor, it is a great town. You know, I couldn't be more excited. I came here to the university in 1985, basically never left. It's just a wonderful place.
Yeah, it is. It truly, and like, well, James and I are also residents of Michigan.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was really nice to, we were not from Ann Arbor, but getting to go up there and discover that city, you know, as a college student was a wonderful experience.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, please. We're just so polite, you know, us Ann Arborites. Going back, so first of all, you go there for college, right? And you're kind of immersed in this town. And, you know, what kind of spoke to you? Because you were a vocal performance major at Michigan.
That's right. Exactly. I came here in 1985 to the music school, as was. I pretty much all of a sudden realized, you know, I came here and Ann Arbor was just an amazing place. It's vibrant, it's engaging, it's accessible, it's welcoming, and you know, even as a college student, I think you perceive that. It's just a sense of the town. You know, I immediately felt comfortable here, and just sort of, you know, enjoyed my time from, you know, from the jump, basically.
And so then, knowing that, you know, where was there some sort of transition, you would say, into getting into politics? You know, like, not to say, you know, we're both artists ourselves, but, you know, everyone has their specific calling getting into something so serious and something that can ultimately be daunting. So how did you make that flip?
Yeah, well, you know, all roads from music school to politics go through law school.
Right.
And, you know, I'm no exception. So I went to music school here, like I said, in 85, and along the way got an English degree as well, and then decided to get work in the get a PhD in American legal history. Because, you know, it was something that interested me. And over time, I, you know, bailed on the history and you know, stuck with the law school. So I became a lawyer. You know, my wife and I, she's a townie here. She graduated from the School of Social Work. We went to Boston for a couple of years and then came back in 2002 after a four-year hiatus out east. And, you know, we came back to Ann Arbor because, you know, we loved Boston. Boston was great, but it was never going to be home. And we both realized that that's what Ann Arbor certainly was for her and was for me as well. So we came on back in 2002. And, you know, my road to politics is probably a common one. I've always liked government. I've always liked policy. These are things that have interested me sort of inherently. But I never felt like I was going to be a participant in it for some reason. I didn't understand how to get involved. It just seemed daunting, and you know, I had my life. But I was having brunch at a friend's house one day late March of 2008, and we started to talk about politics and local politics and state politics. And he's comes from a political family, my pal, and he, you know, eventually got to say, well, you know, shoot, why don't you should be running for city council. And I was like, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. I could never do that. And he asked why, and I told him, you know, my reasons why, you know, I could never be on city council, even though that was sounded cool. And, you know, he basically told me all my reasons were stupid. And he went through how a campaign is run, you know, what it means to be an elected official. You know, it spoke to me, and it really it engaged me and got me activated. And you know, 4 weeks later, I was on the ballot in against an incumbent. 4 months later, I had won the primary, and then that was that.
So what is it like going from running on a, because right now there are so many people. You know, we interviewed previously Amanda Littman, who runs Run for Something, and so people are being encouraged at all levels right now: city council, school board, mayor, Congress, the Senate.
Right.
To run for office, what is that like, making the decision to run for office for the first time and then actually implementing it and running for office? And not only that, you know, only 10%, I think, of people running for the first time win. So you ran against an incumbent and then you won. So I guess what is it like going from, first of all, campaigning for the first time and then winning and then governing?
Yeah. Well, this is at city council. This was at city council. Mayor was back in 2014 for me. But mm-hmm. The transition from sort of, you know, non-elected civilian to candidate to elected, it's a challenging one. You have to be, you know, learn to be in the public more than folks who aren't running for us, the folks who aren't elected. There's a level of notoriety in all the good ways and the less good ways. There's a level of openness that you have with people, and you know, if that's something that engages you, then that's a good thing. I felt like you know, running for office was easier than I had expected it to be. In Ann Arbor, politics is all politics are local. All politics have their own unique flair. Here in Ann Arbor, it's a Democratic town, and so all the action is in the Democratic primary. And the wards are small enough so that if you really work it, you can knock basically every Democratic primary voter door at least once, and in the high turnout precincts twice. And so, you know, that's how politics is done here in Ann Arbor. And I had never done any canvassing before, never done any sort of, you know, one-to-one retail engagement like that. And that was a daunting process. But I came to learn very quickly that people like speaking to the candidate. If the candidate shows up in your door, you say, "Hi, I'm Christopher Taylor. You know, I live at so-and-so, and I'm running for city council." People, you know, 8 times out of 10 want to talk to you. And the 2 times out of 10 where they're not interested in talking to you, they're at least they're pleased that you have the respect for the process to show up and you know, put yourself out there and to reach out to them. And so I felt like it was cleaner and smoother and more affirming than I had feared. Governance is also you know, similar. You know, people in Ann Arbor, I think they love the city, and you know, they're not shy about their opinions. But I think the political culture here it's fairly respectful internally. You know, dissension is understood and part of the game. But you know, we are for the most part not nasty to each other, not nasty about each other, and so it's you know, it's a great place to run. It's a great place to govern.
And that actually brings me to my next question then. So when you're on the other side now, so you're in city council, you know, was it everything that you kind of expected it to be? Was it kind of challenging at first? Was it shocking? Did you discover things, you know, being on the other side now that you are in a elected position?
Well, you certainly get a lot more information. Mm-hmm. You get a lot more understanding, a lot more, you know, well, there's staff there waiting to tell you why things are the way they are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I learned a couple of things my first couple of years on council. The first that, you know, with municipal government, you know, everything begins and ends with water. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, bringing the clean water in, taking the dirty water out, figuring out what to do with the water that shows up either in solid or liquid form. You know, that's what we do. Law enforcement and water and dealing with water is everything. But aside from that, you know, so much of you know, of what you know you perceive as a resident and what you perceive as a, you know, as a new elected official or even an old elected official is, you know, you look at the circumstance of the, you know, whatever problem you're engaging, whatever subject you're engaging, and you're like, huh, why do we do it that way? Shouldn't we do this? And instead of saying, and I've learned to do this, instead of saying, why do we do it that way? We ask, why do we do it that way? Because, you know, people have been working on this for a long time, and people aren't perfect, and our predecessors weren't perfect, but, you know, they were working on it for a long time and trying to do their best. And there are probably reasons why things are the way they are, and that doesn't mean that they have to stay that way, nor should they. But, you know, having that critical distance from the present condition was something that was an important step, I think, in my development as an elected official.
That's awesome. And so now, so you go from city council to mayor, and what was the jump from that, you know, that from city council to mayor like? And then I guess this is now the time I'd love to get into talking about being the mayor of a college town,
yeah,
especially one as big and as fantastic and wonderful. And if you're thinking of applying, you definitely should. It was the greatest experience of my life at the University of Michigan. What was that all like?
Yeah, the transition from council member to mayor was, you know, in some respects, you know, a perfectly understandable one. I'd been a city council member for 6 years before running for mayor. My predecessor had been mayor for 14 years before he stepped down. It was a four-way primary among sitting city council members to replace him. Among those candidates, I was reasonably tagged with the heir apparent label. I was the things are going in the right direction candidate rather than the things aren't going in the right direction candidate. And so, you know, I understood what prior mayor was up to, basically what he did. And so that sort of, you know, from a conceptual basis, that wasn't a big shift. I'd watched and striven to learn. What was hard for me and continues to be is to easily take the head of the table. You know, I tend to be myself more of a listener than a talker. I tend to, you know, want to hear what other people have to say first, and, you know, then to think about it. And that's I think there's a lot that's good about that in the role, but there's also times when the mayor just has to say, we really need to do it this way, and now's the time to do it. And you know, that's my challenge, and that's something that I do work on. In terms of the college town, you know, Ann Arbor is being mayor in Ann Arbor is, as I, you know, probably alluded earlier, it's really a great job. It is a place that people love, and, you know, being mayor of a town like this, you know, you get blamed for things that aren't your doing, but you get credit for things that aren't your doing as well. And, you know, where people love the city, that credit blame balance, I think, you know, works out in the elected officials a favor more likely than not. But in terms of dealing with and engaging the students and the college town, it's the students and the university, of course, add a tremendous vibrancy. You know, without the, you know, it's Ann Arbor as we know it is unimaginable without the university. And it's also, I think, important to note that the university is unimaginable without Ann Arbor. You know, we are well and truly in it together. And although, you know, institutionally there are occasional sort of rub-ups, you know, the folks at the Fleming Building, they are, you know, it's in their interest to have Ann Arbor be a great place to live. And, you know, while, you know, every mayor who, you know, has preceded me and who will follow me would love to have the university break out the checkbook for this, that, and the other thing, you know, that's not their role. That's not their job. That's not their mission. Their mission is not to, you know, ensure that the municipal organization provides excellent services. They are here to be a world-class leader in higher ed, and they're doing an awesome job of it. They need a vibrant, attractive, incredible community for that to succeed. And so, you know, they're here to help and to be part of things and to be partners in solutions. And, you know, the fact that they don't have to follow any of our zoning, our sign ordinances, our, you know, planning processes, you know, we work out those things. But you know, the students, they add vibrancy, they add engagement. They're just an incredible part about being in Ann Arbor, about being a townie here. It's a great place to live.
Yeah, absolutely. And now I'm curious. So, you know, you were talking earlier about how, you know, the heir apparent to John Heefcha and the previous mayor of Ann Arbor, and how it was, you know, you're bringing a similar game plan. With the election of Donald Trump to president of the United States, things have changed nationally on a big scale, on a small scale. There are things that have changed in Ann Arbor. Being the mayor of a college town and being the mayor of a close-knit, pretty liberal community surrounded by a lot of red areas, how has your actions as mayor, how have they changed? Because, you know, if you're going from, people are saying, oh, well, it's a similar game plan to the previous mayor, but he had a very different environment to deal with. So how is your game plan adapted to the current state of things?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Whereas, in terms of, you know, providing, you know, improving basic services, enhancing quality of life, doing the core municipal the core municipal tasks, you know, I think that's where it's steady as she goes. But you're exactly right. The political environment changes with the election of the current president. And I guess, you know, that steps back a little bit to a part of the job that I wasn't really fully keyed in on. And that is, you know, the voice of the community, ceremonial presence, you know, the head of state function of the role. And with the election of Donald Trump representing a community that you know, is entirely at odds with the values that he represents and espouses, it's been important for me to speak out. It's important for me to when, you know, there are, you know, marches here in Ann Arbor or elsewhere to affirm you know, why these moments of activism are occurring. When, you know, the horror show is particularly horrible, it's important for me to speak out and you know, and decry the aid and comfort that white supremacists receive from the White House, to defend you know, verbally and as I can as mayor, the rights and security of everyone in our community, whether, you know, immigrant, refugee, or otherwise. These are things that I think the residents of Ann Arbor demand and expect, and I think it's really important that the mayor deliver.
Yeah, because you know, Ann Arbor is such a tight-knit community, and you know, it feels like no matter where you go, you interact with someone that's your friend about 5 minutes later, you know. And yeah, you know, like one of my favorite restaurants, Sava's, even they unfortunately fell victim to ICE just showing up. You know, some ICE agents sat in, ate food, and then detained three workers. You know, and it's hard because, like, you, these are your friends, these are people you know, and so the, like Nick was saying, the climate has changed so much, and you know, like, but I want to know, like, is Ann Arbor still, has it kind of retained itself, though? Has it kind of said, like, no, we will defend our people, we will defend our friends? And is there, and this is kind of a two-parter question, for those dissenting voices, because while it is a very liberal area, it's the campus and the city at large, you know, there are dissenting voices. There are Republicans there that live there, too. And how are we, you know, How are we shifting that conversation in Ann Arbor so that they're, while their concerns are being voiced, we're all trying to meet some middle ground that, yes, these people do deserve to live here. Yes, we know that there are dissenting opinions about LGBT rights, about how people of color are treated. But how is that conversation going in Ann Arbor right now?
Yeah, we've approached this, I think, in a couple of ways. We have a very active set of residents who are horrified by what's going on in Washington and want to make sure that we do everything we can to combat it. Regrettably, everything we can is not enough. And that's because, we have a limited jurisdiction. We're subordinate to state. We're subordinate to federal. We only have the tools that we have. And so there have been, lots of pushes internally to have, sanctuary city designations declared. And, we don't have authority to do that. We can't say that we're a sanctuary city because, that's factually false. As you said, we can't put, we can't put barriers at the wall and stop ICE from coming in and taking people that that are of no risk or threat to anyone. That's not within our task. We can and have declared ourselves a welcoming city. We follow the welcoming city protocols. We don't have any interest in immigration information, immigration status. That's not something that our police care about. We communicate that every day. We have a legal right to decline to cooperate with detainer requests, and that's we exercise that right. These are things that we can do to make it clear to people that that hate has no place in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. That arbitrary and unreasonable and family destroying deportations and threat of deportations, that those are against our community values. When we've had friends and neighbors and colleagues under threat of deportation or deported, people in Ann Arbor, they come out in March, and they express themselves. They go down to ICE, the ICE offices in Detroit. They let the people know that the people that are targeted are just here trying to have a good life. They're here supporting families, participating in the community, and that when they are taken from us, that we're all lessened for it.
Mm-hmm. Is there a worry that everything is becoming politicized sometimes? Because I think that especially in a community like Ann Arbor that has so many activists, that have people that are marching, like you said, people going door to door, there is a mental fatigue. And the news is constant. So is there ever a worry, as someone who governs, that everything is becoming politicized when there are issues that shouldn't be?
I hear that concern, but I think that we are, we're benefited by activism. We're benefited by engagement. Mm-hmm. I think it's on us to, on the left to keep that engagement up. I don't think we need to, to eat our own and fight among ourselves. And I think we need to know that, I'm a fairly tempered person, and a 90% win is still a win. I'm going to pat everybody in the back and say, we did a lot here, even if we didn't get everything we're looking for. So I think that, we need to, keep that distance from our process. But I think being involved in the process and pushing every day is, it's what we need to do. I think that the country is at a place where stepping away is not an option. I think that, I think we're at a place where we need to, continue to press, continue to make sure that the values that are important to the, to the health of the country going forward, that those are constantly and forcefully expressed.
And I'm also curious, do you discuss with other mayors around the nation? Are there discussions about this sort of thing?
I'm regrettably not a part of a lot of those conversations. One of the beauties of the Ann Arbor system is that it's a strong administrator system. So I am the chair of the board. I'm not the CEO. So mayor in Ann Arbor is a part-time job. So I'm a lawyer on Main Street. I've got a wife and two kids, and so they. Those sorts of external relations, I'll have to wait till the kids are off at college.
Yeah.
And so I would say, you know, and I'm not an expert by any means, but I think Ann Arbor is a pretty perfect city.
I would agree with that.
So,
tell me more, friends. Tell me more.
But I'm curious, you know, what are some ways that you see Ann Arbor growing in the next few years? Are there some significant changes that you would like to see for the city?
Yeah, well, we've got a couple of things going on in the city. I think that, you know, Ann Arbor, you know, has certainly been in the right direction for years. And, you know, I think that we're continuing on with that. We are transitioning from, a college town to a university city. Those are the sorts of issues that we are focusing on, engaging, grappling with here as a community. And that's a transition that is dislocating and disorienting for some. I think we are, working on becoming a more connected community, working on improving transportation, working on, making housing dense where it can be and ought to be, so that we can, improve affordability, reduce traffic throughout the community. We need to make sure, too, municipal financing in Michigan is, under years and years of Republican administration, it's not awesome. And it's not designed to support the provision of high quality municipal services. It's designed to starve the beast. And, we need to, do what we can to make the tax base, available and present so that residents can continue to receive the excellent services that they demand. Those are some of the things that we're working on as a municipal organization. We are, standing up over the next couple of months, on the quality of life side, I think a policing commission. We do not have something like that up and running yet, and that's something that we're focusing on. I think the Ann Arbor police are disciplined and professional and do an excellent job, but it's important that everybody in the community, feel that way too. We all live in America, and it's no shock to learn that people of color in America feel differently about police than people who aren't of color. And, what we need as a government in Ann Arbor is to understand that and accept it as a fact today, but not accept it as a fact tomorrow. We need to do everything we can to combat it. We need to do everything we can to make sure that people who come into Ann Arbor know that the police are there for everyone and that they're going to be treated without bias or favor.
That's amazing. I love that. That's the what you said. Building the next university city from a college town to a university city, I think is amazing, and just shows like the progress of Ann Arbor, which is continuously voted one of the best places in America to live, the most literate city. Really, we can't. Honestly, Mayor
I wish
Taylor,
I could
we
go
cannot
back.
Go
yeah.
on and on.
I want to go back. Like, I just want to, it makes me warm and fuzzy, and I just want to be there yeah. right now.
You lived in, because we both
Come
lived
on
in.
Over. I'll give you a great big hug.
Oh, we'd
be
love
lovely.
To. Well, we'll be back hopefully soon, because we both lived in Carytown, too. You live in
well,
Carytown.
Well, I live
right?
close to it.
I live in Carytown.
But speaking of that, make sure, if you can do anything for us, use your mayoral powers to just send us some Zingermans. That's all I ask.
Excellent.
that's all I could ask for.
Yeah, we
know. I was at the Roadhouse for brunch today for my mom's birthday.
Oh, really? Susan said she saw the pictures on Facebook. Susan's
yes,
Hannah's
exactly.
mom for podcast listeners.
Live studio
there.
Audience.
Live studio audience today. We're very excited to have her. Two Ann Arbor legends on the pod today.
Yes.
So we want to ask, as we sort of wind down in our interview, you've gone from a music school student to law school to getting a degree, a PhD in American history. Then you ran for city council and you were inspired by your friend, which is amazing. And now you've gone on to being mayor of, again, one of the greatest cities in America, in our humble opinion. What are some recommendations you have for people listening on this podcast that might be considering running for office?
Slightly correct the record, did not get the PhD.
Or did not get it.
Yeah, so let the record show. But in terms of, advice to people who are running for office, my advice is just simply do it. I don't know anybody who's run for office who has felt like that it was wasted time. Even win or lose, you get a perspective on the community that is unknowable beforehand. You learn so much about the community. You learn so much about the process of governance. And it's a really good experience. You know, people, in your campaign will be, working with you to achieve some goal, whether it's, state, local, national. These are noble efforts, and none of us are perfect. And that other person who's running, they may have advantages that you don't have, but they're not perfect either. And if you have if your vision of whatever jurisdiction you're working in, if your vision is in accord with the folks that are pulling the levers, it can happen for you, and you won't be sorry. You won't be sorry for the effort.
Thank you. I love beautiful. That. Just run. You got to run. You got to get into it.
That is exactly. We need good people running. We need people who are taking responsibility, who are putting themselves out there, and expressing the values, advocating for the values that are important to them.
Well, we are thankful that your call for good people to run, and we are thankful for having a good person already in office in you. So, Mayor Taylor, we wanted to thank you again so much for coming on the podcast. We truly appreciate it. We'd love to talk to you again in the future.
Yeah.
Because we love Ann Arbor, and we love the work that you're doing.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you so much for calling. This has been great.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Guys, if you want to follow us on social media, we are WeRebelPodcast@gmail.com. First of all, if you want to send us an email.
Yeah, I got questions.
Yes, please send them. And then WeRebelPodcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So make sure you hit us up on one of those. And other than that.
Oh, leave us a rating on iTunes. That's always nice.
Apple we Podcast, like the, rather.
I'm sorry, yes. Apple Podcast. I'm going to get in trouble.
Yes. All right. and also, lastly, we should say go blue.
Go blue.
Wonderful. That's the big one. So we'll see everyone next week.
Fire.
This is Marcy Jarrow.
This is Jessica Jardin.
We're the co-hosts of Kardashianit, a podcast about all things Kardashian.
Each week, we watch every episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians and every dang spinoff imaginable, recapping all the drama for you.
We talk about everything to do with Kardashians, all the latest news, pop culture, feminism, who's pregnant, answer all of them at some point, maybe even Rob, and even sports if one of them's dating an athlete.
Or a rapper, and we'll probably get their names wrong. So subscribe to Kardashianit on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us. Thank you.
Goodbye.